This is the United Nations. From Lake Success, we bring you Food for Thought, a program produced in consultation with the Food and Agriculture Organization, a specialized agency of the United Nations.
This is the story of a very plain man, and a very great man, a man whose first thought is for food, for others. A man whose voice has said many times,
by putting first things first and doing the things which we know to be right, we will set agriculture, industry, and trade in an upward spiral of prosperity.
Our friend, and he is, I promise you, our friend in the largest and most generous sense of the word, our friend has always put first things first and come directly, even bluntly, to the point. For example, someone recalls this.
The occasion was a lunch with a high church dignitary. And this dignitary had been saying that the churches, in their zeal for the salvation of souls, had grossly neglected social welfare. And all of a sudden, John butted in and said, "You're very right. The Bible says that the body is the temple of the spirit. Now, what sort of a temple is it? If it's afflicted with rickets, and perhaps has a nasty permanent discharge from one ear."
Who is this John, this friend of ours with the pocky Scots wit? And why should you hear about him? Well, he's Sir John Boyd Orr. Now you may well say,
"Orr? Boyd Orr? I never heard of him."
Well, he talks common sense. He gets things done. He has added immeasurably to the health and happiness of millions of people. He has saved the lives of children yet unborn. He is important to Canada, but he's important to the people in Britain and India and Central Africa. He's important to farmers and doctors and scientists, because he is all of those things, and a prophet as well. But chiefly, he's important to people. When he was Director General of FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, he didn't mince words.
"Our aim is that every man, woman, and child in the world should have the food he needs to be really healthy. Now, if the United Nations can't agree upon that one simple fundamental aim, there's nothing in God's earth they will agree about."
Maybe you think this is a bleak sort of way to start a radio portrait of such a man, if he's as important as we say he is. Maybe about now we should conjure up fanfares and upsurges of music. But John Boyd Orr wouldn't like frills, and it wouldn't suit him.
"Say, this Boyd Orr, maybe I have heard of him. Didn't I read someplace that he'd been made a baron or something?"
Yes, you're right. He has been made a baron, and frankly, at the time of doing this radio portrait of him, we don't know what name he's chosen. Anyway, I think you should know how we have set about building up this story. For one thing, we went to Washington, D.C., and with sound recording gear, we went about collecting material from people who are close to John Boyd Orr. From people who have been working with him, people who could fill in bits of human background, people whose faces lit up when you mentioned his name. For instance, there was Frank McDougall, counselor to the director of the Food and Agriculture Organization.
"I've known John Orr for the last 20 years.
There was Dorothy Graham, who hails from Edmonton and Fort Saskatchewan in Alberta.
"I was Sir John Orr's secretary for about 2.5 years. And during that time, he gave probably 100 speeches and goodness knows how many radio broadcasts."
We turn to David Lubbock, Sir John Orr's former assistant in the technical field, who is now his son-in-law.
"Like the late Lord Rutherford in physics, he seemed to have a prescience of fundamentals in biology."
And finally, we asked Anne Pat, his granddaughter, aged 7, what Sir John Orr looked like. And she said,
"He is not very big. He is kind of middle-sized."
Kind of middle-sized. And then she added one very important point.
"He has a big, bushy eyebrows."
Big, bushy eyebrows. Those eyebrows, by the way, with a pair of penetrating, quizzical eyes twinkling beneath them, are characteristics everyone associates with Sir John.
When Sir John dictated, or when he was thinking deeply, he always twisted his very long white eyebrow with his left hand, while with his right hand he doodled large geometric doodles on whatever was in front of him. Usually by the end of the day, the blotter on his desk was completely covered with doodles, and perhaps important documents and letters were also covered with doodles, which later had to be erased by me.
And so, through these and other friends, some of whose voices you will hear again, the picture of John Boyd Orr began to emerge, to have dimensions and warmth. Then we set about digging into recordings and motion picture reels, and the rugged face, the bushy eyebrows, the pipe, stood out still more before our eyes. Now to begin the story. You, sir, you come from Kilmarnock.
The most important thing about Sir John Boyd Orr is that he's a Scotsman. His father intended that his son should wag his pow in the pulpit, and so John Orr took his M.A. at Glasgow University in preparation for divinity. But he began to take up with zoology and biology and the like, and that led him away. He became a teacher and then returned to the university to become a doctor. Then he got interested in social problems and research and in nutrition, which was newfangled then. But it came out all right in the end. And by 1914, he was John Boyd Orr, M.A., M.D., D.S.C. Aye, and by the end of the war, he'd been both a soldier and a sailor, and he'd got more tags to the end of his name. They were D.S.O. and M.C. He'd won the M.C. twice. Aye, a very canny young Scot was John Boyd Orr, and a very brave one, too.
The English journalist Richie Calder is one of those who have followed Sir John's career from the days when he first began to be known.
I'd gone to Aberdeenshire in 1931 on a duty assignment which was not particularly exciting. I'd been told that I ought to be showing an active interest in animal nutrition. Menus for pigs, I called it then. And that the man I ought to see was a Dr. John Boyd Orr. I'd never heard of him. Well, I met there a reticent, I might even say a truculent Scotsman. We got to know one another, however, and up on a hilltop to which we wandered, he expounded the articles of his faith. He preached what he's since been trying to put into practice. An Old Testament prophet talking the New Testament language of the brotherhood of man, but a prophet with his feet solidly on the ground.
John Orr's theme then and his theme now are the same. It amounts to this. A civilization which cannot provide the primary necessities of life for its people is one which cannot endure. The most urgent material need of the world today is food. Prolonged hunger causes social and political unrest and hinders cooperation not only between nations, but even within nations. Statesmen are finding difficulties in laying the foundations for permanent peace. But they have their eyes on the wrong goal. Hunger is at the heart of the world's troubles. Unless people are fed, the best treaties and agreements can come to nothing. Hungry people cannot be satisfied by anything but food.
When John Orr spoke then, when he speaks now, he speaks from knowledge and experience. His institute in Scotland had studied the living conditions, diet, and health of two tribes in Africa, one meat-eaters and blood-drinkers, the other cereal-eaters and milk-drinkers. The report on these tribes is one of the classics of the literature of nutrition. Then he'd taken 200 children in a miners' community in Lanarkshire and had fed them experimentally for a year. They grew and blossomed before his very eyes, but nobody heeded. So he turned from nutritional experiment to social research. He made a survey that was to become the famous Food, Health, and Income Survey. The move wasn't a popular one. It revealed some very unpleasant facts, which incidentally were by no means peculiar to Britain. And his colleagues didn't warm to the idea.
It's all very well, but I say he should stick to his test tubes. A scientist's place is in the laboratory. Otherwise, he just becomes an innocent abroad. What he's doing now is...
Now, tell me, who cares for this doctor's views on economics? What on earth does he know about them? From some very distressing premises that are proved... He is drawing some vastly inconclusive conclusions that can't be proved, if you know what I mean. Mark my words.
John Boyd Orr's facts and figures in food, health, and income rocked the social conscience of his countrymen. It was incontrovertibly shown that millions of people, particularly millions of children, future citizens, lived below standards where health could be maintained. These facts may not have been pleasing to some, but the government made him that year Sir John Boyd Orr. When we used our recorder in Washington, Mr. Lubbock threw some light on this period of Sir John's crusade.
And he showed that those who were consuming diets which were poor in quality had health conditions which were inferior to those who were eating good diets. Now, the Food, Health and Income was the first piece of work that has ever been done on analyzing the whole of that situation for a country, as a nation.
Sir John's views were influencing many people in many lands, and among them two distinguished Australian friends, Frank McDougall and Stanley Bruce, now Viscount Bruce. These two were bringing pressure to bear at the League of Nations in Geneva, where a marriage of food and agriculture was finally effected.
John Orr not being at Geneva, the Australian delegation raised the whole question of nutrition in the General Assembly. As soon as it was clear that that initiative was going very well, Bruce, Lord Delaware and I sent a telegram to John Orr. And the telegram read like this: Brother Orr, we have lit such a candle in Geneva today as by God's grace shall not lightly be put out.
To adapt the metaphor, John Orr and his friends had indeed helped light a candle to the sins of the world. The functionaries who that day in Geneva thought that the problem of nutrition would at best get talked off the agenda in a scant hour were astounded to hear the nations debating it over a period of 3 days. The social conscience of the world had been aroused.
The common sense of the philosophy that food is grown to be eaten, not just to be marketed, that food is life and not just a commodity, that there were millions who were undernourished, that the farmers who had it in their power to feed the world were themselves among the undernourished, that from malnutrition, from hunger, there could come nothing but evil, that from the growth of more food, the eating of more food, the raising of standards of living, nothing but good could come. These were the simple facts set forth to the world by plain men of good sense and great heart, and these were facts that even the cleverest and the subtlest of politicians could understand.
Sir John continued his work in Britain, where it helped to create the climate which produced, without social stress or political dispute, the British rationing system at the outbreak of war. The basis of rationing in terms of human needs and well-being had already been defined and accepted. That rationing system, with Boyd Orr on the Cabinet's technical committee, brought Britain through a 6-year war healthier than when she'd entered it. The consumption of nutritional essentials had been levelled up and levelled down. The poor were better fed. The rich were none the worse for being less well fed.
In films and broadcasts during the war in Britain, Sir John Boyd Orr's voice and personality were becoming known outside the group of nutrition experts and familiar to the general public. At that time, they heard him say this:
There's a big difference between not having enough food to eat and not eating enough of the right kind of food for good health. People used to think that the food was good enough if they felt their bellies full. But in the last 20 years or so, we have completely changed our ideas about food requirements. We have discovered that there are certain substances in food which are necessary for health. The most important of these are the vitamins. In Britain before the war, if you'd felt hungry, you could have sat down and had a few hunks of white bread with margarine and jam. You'd satisfy your sense of hunger, but that's about all. For health, you'd want foods with plenty of vitamins in them, such as milk, eggs, fruit, and vegetables. But they'd cost you twice as much. Hence, the poorer the family, the less they could buy of the more costly but quite essential vitamin-rich foods. And there are quite a few people in Britain, you know, who have to live on less than £2, that's $10, a week. In Britain, before the war, we were providing milk for school children and giving milk and other health foods free to poor mothers. As a result, the general health of the people was steadily getting better. If you compare 1913 with 1939, you'll see what I mean. In 1913, nearly half of the children in our industrial towns were suffering from rickets, a disease caused by lack of vitamins. But by 1939, this disease had almost completely vanished. We know that better feeding increases resistance to tuberculosis, and the death rate from that disease had fallen by about 50%. Children leaving school in 1938 were between 2 and 3 inches taller than their parents were at the same age.
All this shows how easily health and physique can be improved.
It was a good start. People in Britain listening to Sir John Bordeaux during the war realized that the good start that had been made was being held to, was not being sacrificed. British scientists heard him say,
"In this country, war has forced us to adopt a food policy based on efficient meat. We no longer produce what the farmer thinks will give him the biggest profit. We produce the food we need to produce to feed the nation."
The war years brought their toll of sorrow. Sir John's only son was lost in action with the RAF. He and others like him were determined that these sacrifices would not be in vain, and that out of the war would come, must come, what the Atlantic Charter proclaimed, freedom from want.
So as soon as the shooting war is finished, we're pledged to win the other war. We're pledged to go on fighting until we have fulfilled the promise to bring freedom from want to all men in all lands. Freedom from want means food for everybody on the new gold standard of health. The United States and the British Commonwealth of Nations have called on all nations to join them in these post-war aims. Plain people know what they want. They want security. And that doesn't mean dole, relief, or charity. The common man everywhere demands freedom from want. He demands it not only for himself, but for all men. There must be no more forgotten people. We cannot attain freedom from want till every man, woman, and child, especially the mothers and the little children, shall have enough of the right kind of food to enable them to develop their full inherited capacity for health and well-being. People talk glibly of planning and reconstruction, but we do not know yet what our cities will be like or where they will be. But we do know that we can plan a food policy based on the human needs of all. This may be the first good, solid thing to come out of the war.
The first good, solid thing to come out of the war. Here was a goal within reach. Here were words that could be understood and acted upon. Yes, even in the darkest days of war, people were working for peace. The words and the voice of Sir John Orr himself were heard at the Virginia Hot Springs Conference during the war that led to the inception of the Food and Agriculture Organization, now one of the great specialized agencies of the United Nations.
Sir John himself wasn't at that conference in Virginia. Maybe he'd been considered unorthodox by someone. But his voice was there and his face was there, rugged as if whittled with a jackknife, it thrust forward from a motion picture screen, and the delegates rose and cheered.
There followed in Quebec, on the heels of the ending of the war in Japan, the meeting that formed the Food and Agriculture Organization. Sir John Orr was there himself on that occasion.
Yes, but only as a technical advisor. And in that capacity, he made only one speech to the conference. After that speech, he went off on a solitary climb to the Heights of Abram, and there, deputies from the conference, like the elders of the congregation, followed the prophet to the mountaintop and led him back to make him director general by acclamation.
The gathering on food problems there at Quebec was one of the first great meetings that expressed the will of the nations to cooperate, come what may.
Under the flags of 45 nations, this doctor, scientist, farmer raised his hand and took the international oath. He renounced all allegiance except to the peoples of the world. He owed fealty to no government. Since United Nations was still unborn, he became the first world citizen. From the outset, however, he made it clear that the charter of FAO did not satisfy him. It made it a fact-finding, advisory organization. It was restricted to investigation of world problems of food, agriculture, nutrition, fisheries, forestry, and rural economy. It could only make suggestions and tender advice, which governments could ignore. He said bitterly, "The people are crying out for bread and we offer them pamphlets."
Sir John Bordeaux put the Food and Agriculture Organization to work tackling worldwide problems. At the close of the war, Sir John was one of those men with vision. Not a vision of idle peace and relaxation, but of the work that had to be done first to achieve peace. Of the people in the world who were faint with hunger, people who would die if the world did nothing for them. He worked with UNRWA. He called a famine conference. An International Emergency Food Council was created. When the second annual meeting of the Food and Agriculture Organization was held in Copenhagen, he and his experts had an impressive collection of uncomfortable facts to present and some far-reaching but fundamentally simple plans to put forward. From recordings made at Copenhagen, we invoked the voice of that great American, the late Fiorello LaGuardia, who was at that conference. And here's what he had to say in part.
In many places of the world, and this is particularly true in my country, there's always the right person for a great crisis. And the world has been fortunate in this instance that there was a John Orr. And it must be gratifying, after a long life of pioneering, I can tell you, there isn't anything more difficult than trying to be a pioneer in government. Oh, you must be able to take a lot of abuse and sneers and jeers. It becomes discouraging at times. But this great leader, and never weakened, and was never discouraged. And the mere fact that it has been possible to create a world organization formed by governments with 46 members, and to gather a great conference of this kind to at least listen to these recommendations, is great progress indeed, Sir John, and I want to congratulate.
Mr. LaGuardia's speech had all the fire and passion, all the charm and humor he could infuse into what he said. He talked in terms that Sir John must have liked, regarding the intention to improve the lot of the farmer, to give him a stable market.
You can go into any art gallery in any city of the world, and you will see beautiful paintings of the happy peasant tilling the soil. Beautiful colored costume, a smile, the sun shining, the crop coming up. Oh, it's such a pretty picture. The poets have sung about the peasant. But the peasants and the farmers have been exploited since time immemorial in every country of the world, including my own.
And as he warmed to his subject, he said,
I want to be very frank with you. No matter what this conference does, we are not going to let the American farmer down. We want to bring the standards of the farmers of other countries up, and we refuse to bring the standard of our farmers down. Yeah, you can applaud now, but you may not get applause on that one when you go home.
Soon, the countries of the world were facing up to the problems outlined and the plans prepared by Sir John Boyd Orr. His FAO was hard at work. At a later meeting, the Canadian delegate said,
Canada has no brief or any particular approach to the attainment of the objectives endorsed at Copenhagen. We are willing, and we hope every other country represented here on this commission will be willing, to study with an open mind the possibilities of a World Food Board along the lines proposed by Sir John Boyd Orr, as well as any other plans of action that may be advanced.
In these post-war years, the figure of Sir John Boyd Orr becomes merged with the plans he has been promoting, plans for increasing agricultural production, for checking soil erosion, for bettering farming methods and marketing methods. Between Quebec and Copenhagen and Geneva and Washington, he made his way, his eyebrows and his pipe, making him a familiar figure to many who knew only faintly what he was doing for them.
Anybody who knows Sir John Orr knows that he smoked a pipe constantly. He had dozens of pipes. But in spite of that fact, after every large meeting which he attended, he would find that he didn't have his pipe with him. The result was that we searched for his pipe in the House of Commons in London, in the halls of the Riksdagen in Copenhagen, and in the halls of the Palais de Nation in Geneva.
As far as we know at this moment, Sir John Orr with Lady Orr is up on his farm in Scotland, where, no doubt, he is still occasionally looking for that pipe. He is retired from the job of being Director General of FAO, of the Food and Agriculture Organization, which has its headquarters in Washington, but keeping a sharp eye on what's developing. At this very time, the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations is meeting at Lake Success, and on the agenda are at least two such items of interest to him. If you tuned into the United Nations radio, you might hear the announcer explain.
The report has just been circulated here of the Food and Agriculture Organization on the progress in the coordination of studies of suitable measures to bring about an increase in food production. The Economic and Social Council has requested...
Most of us are anxious about peace. Maybe we've intrigued you by something more than the engaging personality of a canny Scotsman who has promoted over a period of many years certain very sound ideas. You know these ideas are mixed up with many great and complex problems of which the average person has little grasp. The steady growth of world population, the shrinkage and wastage of the world's natural resources, the erosion of its soils, and the lessening of its food supplies. You know that hunger breeds evil and disease and war, and that there is no solution except to keep on working. Sir John Boyd Orr has the final word. You're in a darkened theater. On the motion picture screen, the British documentary film, The World is Rich, is coming to an end. It has told the story of food and how people are still hungry, although we have the means to produce more food. Sir John Orr has contributed, and you've heard his voice and seen his face. The argument concludes. The music rises to a climax. You again hear his voice as on the screen flash the words, "The end."
That's not the end. FAO exists. It has a plan. But the plan will work only if governments want it to work. And the governments will want it to work if you, the people of the world, demand that it shall work.
No, this is not the end.
It's the beginning of a great world plan which will put common sense into the affairs of men. A plan which will put politics and economics on the road to world prosperity and world peace.